All right, it's 10 past three, time to start. There's a bunch of you in the audience who've seen me present before, so thank you for coming back. Obviously means I didn't do a terrible job last time. Sorry about the room. You people kind of over there, hello. This might be the last time you see me, and same for you down there. They moved me because I'm, for the first time in my life, I'm actually popular. I honestly don't know what to do. I'm like, a little bit confused. So welcome to my session, Getting Foxy with Azure Infrastructure as a Service. This actually isn't my original session title. My original session title was Azure, What Does the Fox Say? But you know, we worked around a bit and we've come up with Getting Foxy with Azure Infrastructure as a Service. So this session is kind of aimed at a couple of things. First, to kind of cover up some of the basics of Azure Infrastructure as a Service, and that's probably 10 minutes. The next 30 minutes is going to be about, or 35 minutes, maybe a bit longer, is really about thinking beyond the infrastructure as a service stack and what are the other things that we can do with Azure that will help our lives as IT pros. So I assume there's a bunch of you in here who's kind of not aware that Azure runs virtual machines. Anyone? Good. So Azure does a bunch of stuff, right? It's a pretty big platform, and look, there'll be a test on this afterwards. Don't worry too much about the picture. The picture is just to say, hey, Azure's got all these features, and in fact, this is taken from a Microsoft slide deck. It's already out of date. This was only done a few months ago. It's already out of date. Microsoft have released machine learning, Azure Search, Azure Document DB, and I think automation is even missing off this as well. So they're releasing stuff at a phenomenal rate. And I guess it's kind of easy to be involved in your day jobs and kind of not get a view of what kind of the broad bits and pieces are that Azure does and how you can use them as IT pros rather than you know, just going, hey, it runs some virtual machines, because running virtual machines is pretty easy, right? So that's what we're going to kind of cover, some of the basics and some of the extra stuff you can do. So let's start with the basics. So I'm not going to talk about virtual machines and all that sort of stuff. I'm going to just tell you a couple of things around what you need to do and what you need to think about with virtual machines. First one is choose the right virtual machine type. So you've got an option in the portal of choosing a basic or a standard VM. There's really a couple of major differences. Basic VMs don't have any high availability built into them, so there's no load balancer in front of them, but they are a lower cost tier. So if you need to do stuff at a low cost and you don't need the availability features, then you can use the basic. It's, you know, I think they're about 30 or 40% cheaper than a standard VM. But they do have one minor drawback, which is that they've got less I/O per disk. And so you have to factor that in when you're making your choices, right? So it's just a planning consideration. Consider basic VMs cheaper, but less I/O. And you can't run as many VM sizes on the basic VM. So you've got kind of, I think, five VM sizes you can run basic and a few more, the real monster ones you can run in standard. If you're in a scenario where you need the load balancer, you've got, you know, you're running services that need load balancing, there's seats over there if anyone needs seats, if you can get there. If you need the load balancer, then use standard VMs. So the next thing, next basic, is manage your availability. So remember that Azure isn't a enterprise-style cloud where machines are live migrated from host to host when maintenance happens. When Microsoft do maintenance on the Azure Fabric, your stuff can go down. I'm really careful not to swear. I watched James Whittaker's session early on today, and like I'm all sweary now after watching him. So, you know, if I say shit, just ignore it. It's not an enterprise style cloud. It's a build for fail cloud. So, you've got to build your availability in. So, there's a few ways you do that. One is that you use standard VMs with the load balancer. But you also have to do a step called creating an availability set. And that tells the Azure Fabric these machines are part of a set that need to be maintained under an SLA, and you aren't allowed to reboot both those machines at the same time or both those hosts at the same time. And if you do that, if you've got two VMs or more in an availability set, hey, the Azure SLA kicks in, 99.95% availability. If you've got one VM running, what's your SLA? Anyone know? Zero. You've got no SLA. If Microsoft need to do maintenance on the host that happens to be running on, goodbye your machine. So just something to plan for. You do need to understand that. And so, you know, if you're doing this, use a load balancer for any traffic coming from the internet that needs to hit those devices, and that will ensure that your traffic is sent to the right place. And if one of them disappears, well, you know, then all good, your service is maintained. If you're doing internal only services, so you've got maybe a SQL backend or, you know, some sort of web facing backend, you can use the internal load balancer. It's a new functionality they released a couple of months ago. So the internal load balancer lets you provide load balancing services, internal IP address on your own virtual network, and, you know, great for providing high availability backend services. Not through the portal, unfortunately, but is through the through PowerShell. And then for every tier you've got, use a separate availability set. So don't combine, don't go, I've got this web app, which is, you know, my IIS servers and my SQL servers, and they're all part of the same, you know, application. Don't create that as one availability set, because potentially you could lose, you know, two IIS servers in the server, and Azure Fabric goes, well, they're an availability set. I've lost two IIS servers, that's fine. The service should be running on these two SQL servers. So separate your tiers into logical groups of availability. IIS is one, SQL is one, mid-tier is another, you know, so keep those things separate. So, you know, manage your availability. You have to do this. This is something you have to think about, you know, and build your application for. Use the VM agent. So the VM agent is, and we'll look at this in a second, but the VM agent is a bit of software that Microsoft ship that runs on Azure VMs, and it runs on Windows and Linux VMs. Anyone not know that Azure runs a bunch of Linux VMs as well? It does, just in case. So the VM agent, that it runs inside the VM, and it lets, there's a bunch of functionality exposes. So the obvious example is when you run up an Azure VM with the agent installed, there's a BG Info extension already installed. So you can log into your VM, you see all the BG Info stuff there. But there's a couple other useful bits and pieces. There's one called the VM Access extension, and that lets you, if you've forgotten the admin password for your machine for some reason, you can actually go in through PowerShell and reset the admin password to something you kind of remember. I think you still have to know what the admin username is, though, but you can reset the password. If you think RDP's been buggered up by something, then you can go in and fix RDP. There's a new bit of functionality they announced recently called Windows Azure Diagnostics, which are kind of like, I guess, perfmon counters. And so you can capture those perfmon counters to an Azure storage account and then view them in the new Azure portal, and as opposed to the existing one. So you'll find there are two portals at the moment as they kind of move. And you can then download those off your storage account and analyze them yourself. So if you need to do diagnostics, you need the VM agent enabled. And there's some custom script stuff. So there's a bunch of extensions. And so they add extra functionality and they make your life easier for using you know, Azure VMs. So you could be tempted to turn it off. I don't know why you would. You might have some security concerns, I suppose, about other software that's running on your VMs. Try not to turn it off, though. It does add value. Use virtual networks if you need them. When might you need a virtual network? Well, a bunch of scenarios. Hybrid scenario, I want to extend my internal LAN and make Azure just look like a part of my internal network. So you can do that with an IPsec VPN site-to-site from your network to Azure. You might be using the Express Route feature for a dedicated connection. If you need to do that, then great, use virtual networks. If you've got cloud services that need to communicate directly with each other over an internal network, then virtual networks you'll need. It does give you slightly better isolation. You can run services that are completely internal facing and not exposed to the internet at all. So again, great for that. If you want to define your own IP ranges, your own subnetting, those kinds of things, then again, virtual networks. And if you need access to internal services, say you've got a line of business application you need to integrate with, one way to do that is via, you know, the creating a virtual network, setting up the VPN and coming over the VPN to your internal service. There are scenarios where you might not, if you're just standing up a VM that you need to run a website on, hey, you might not need a virtual network at all, just run it up on an Azure network and it'll be fine. So it's just something, another thing to consider and plan for that accordingly. PowerShell, use PowerShell. I've been speaking at TechEd since 2008, I think. And I think every year I say, learn PowerShell. So who's learned PowerShell? Oh, yes, you guys don't listen to me. You come along to these sessions, but you don't listen, do you? So look, use PowerShell. It'll make your life easier. There's stuff you you just can't do through the portal. For instance, the internal load balancer, you can't. It's not even exposed in the portal. If you want to set up the internal load balancer, you've got to use PowerShell. So there is stuff you can do only in PowerShell, but actually it makes your life easier, it makes your life more repeatable. It is actually a bit faster if you need to spin up multiple VMs. There is a bunch of stuff. So install the Azure PowerShell commandlets, get used to using them. They're really powerful, they do heaps of stuff. You just install them from the web platform installer, free download, and away you go. So we'll talk a bit more about PowerShell in a second. So what I thought I'd do is just give you a couple of quick looks at the basics. Okay. Just so you're aware of kind of where they are. So Azure Portal, this is the existing Azure Portal. There is a new portal. I kind of referred to that through the VM diagnostics. But the Azure Portal, you've probably seen it like 100 times in 100 different sessions. I just wanted to call out a couple of things. I want to create a new VM. I'm just going to use Windows because that's what I do. Give it a name. So you can see here your tier. So if I want to choose between basic and standard, I can choose that here. And my size, I talked about sizing appropriately. So that's where you do your choose your appropriate size. And the other bit here, we'll do that, that's fine, is the VM agent. So install the VM agent, it's on by default. Like I say, leave it there unless you've got some really good reasons to turn it off. It does some cool things. You can actually see there that Microsoft also added a bunch of support for things like Puppet and Chef. So if you want to run a configuration management system based on those things, then you can point it off at your Puppet or Chef server and have the machine configured as you come up. And also there's these security extensions which are published through now as well, so you get your various different antivirus, anti-malware environments published, built automatically as part of the Azure VM. I'm not going to provision that because there's no point provisioning a VM. The other bit I just wanted to quickly show you, just to make sure you're aware, is availability sets. Now you can set up availability sets if you're building PowerShell. You can configure the availability set as part of the machine provisioning. If you do it through the portal, you have to come in later and select an availability set, and you just go create an availability set, and we'll call it AV set 01. And if I go save, it'll probably tell me it's going to reboot the machine and do funny things. Yep, it's going to be restarted. And I'll do that. And so that's added that VM into an availability set. Obviously, I need two VMs in an availability set. So I need to go back to the second machine once this one's finished and add that second machine to the availability set. And then my SLA kicks in, 99.95% availability. Until I do that, nothing. Okay, so it could all disappear if Microsoft decide to do some maintenance. So that's kind of all I wanted to show you around the basics, because I kind of want to get on to how do we get more out of Azure and how do we do more stuff. Not that one, that one. What have I done? Oh, good Lord. That come up? No. Oh. Mr. AV guy, I've done something bad. Oh no, it's good. It's working. So it's pitch black up here. I can't actually see the numbers on the thingies. So how do I get more out of Azure? So I assume there's no developers in the room. About three of them. Okay. Well, you guys probably know this stuff anyway. And I guess some of the things you could think about. Think about maybe thinking a bit more like a developer, and start thinking about some of the things around automation and those kinds of things. And this is kind of where we're going with this. So how do I get more out of Azure? How do I, as an IT pro, use some of the Azure features that sit around the outside of virtual machines to make my Azure experience better? So that's kind of what I want to talk about for the next little while. So first one, think like a developer and automate everything. So there are a couple of interesting automation tools that Microsoft provide. So the first one's Azure Automation. Second one, I said I'd talk about PowerShell. Again, actually both these things are PowerShell technology. The PowerShell desired state config agent. So let's talk about those. So Azure Automation. So it's a feature that's currently in preview. And what Azure Automation does is it brings a concept of runbook authoring into the Azure portal. So I can build a PowerShell-based runbook in the Azure portal, and I can use that to do all manner of crazy things to my Azure environment. So that could be deployment, it could be management, could be monitoring, could be reacting to events. It could be all sorts of things. And so what I do is I build a PowerShell workflow-based automation, and I publish that through into Azure, and then I can use that. I can run it manually. I can set it up to run on a schedule. And so I can do all kinds of things. But you know, there's a couple of examples there: backup SQL Azure on a schedule, patch Azure VMs, you know, whatever it happens to be. There are a bunch of scenarios. What Azure gives you is a highly available engine for running these workflows. So it is built to run at Azure scale. So all you do is take care of kind of building your workflows. Microsoft will take care of making sure that your workflows run and they're run in the right place and you know, the engine's highly available, that kind of thing. And I can also extend that and say, hey, I want to do some stuff with other stuff I've got PowerShell for. I can import my own PowerShell modules in there. So if I need to do stuff with Active Directory, I can import the Active Directory PowerShell module and start doing stuff with that. So there's all kinds of things you can do with this, and it's very extensible and very powerful. The other really cool thing about Azure Automation is that if you're not aware, there's a bit of functionality that sits inside System Center Orchestrator called Service Management Automation. And it's this, but for on-premises environments. So you can take the service management automation components of System Center Orchestrator, run them on-premises, sit them underneath Windows Azure Pack, and actually you can provide a similar experience using PowerShell-based workflow, using a scalable workflow engine. You can do all this stuff on-premises. So those things align really, really nicely. So it's, I don't know if there are any sessions on service management automation. I think there might be one later on in the week. It's quite a cool technology to dig into as well for your kind of on-premises environments. So that's Azure Automation. The other bit is this PowerShell Desired State Configuration Agent. Who knows what PowerShell Desired State Configuration is? Handful. Okay. So PowerShell Desired State Config is a bit of functionality that's now built into PowerShell, and it allows you to create configurations using in PowerShell, a desired configuration for a VM, and then apply that configuration to a VM, and the VM will make the VM look like that. So it's like a puppet or a chef. You basically build what you want the machine to look like. You say, machine, here's what I want you to look like. It will take care of making sure it actually, PowerShell DSC then takes care of making sure that the right things happen. You know, it could be, make sure these Windows services these Windows features are installed. Make sure this Windows service is set to enabled. Make sure this registry entry is in place. Make sure this file's in place. Make sure these firewall rules are in place. Those kinds of things. It's an extensible model, so you can kind of make it, you know, jump through hoops and do whatever you like. So PowerShell Desired State Config is handy, and you can use it on premises, and point your VM, your VMs can be used. You can configure your VMs up with this thing. What the PowerShell DSC extension does for Azure is it lets you store a configuration a desired configuration in Azure Storage, and then it lets you point a VM to that that configuration and apply it to that VM. So you can do that kind of at deploy time. So I'm building a new machine, I want it to look like what my desired configuration says. Or you can do it anytime you like and say reapply it to the VM. You can say, hey, go and refresh yourself and make sure that you actually do meet what my desired state says you should. It's all run through PowerShell. It's not currently in the portal. I don't know if it ever will come into the portal. I'm not sure. It is quite a PowerShell driven anyway, so it may not make sense for them to bring it into the portal. So it's a really powerful feature to build machines. And there are other ways you can do this. You know, you can use PowerShell remoting. Every VM that comes up every Windows machine that comes up through the portal actually has a PowerShell endpoint exposed. So you could remotely connect using PowerShell remoting and run those commands remotely yourself. But actually this way means you don't even have to worry about that. You just say, go and look at that configuration over there, make yourself look like that, and it'll be done for you. So it's a great little feature for that. And so what we'll do is we'll have a look at that there. Cool. There you go. You get a warning if you only have one machine in an availability set. just so you know. So I'll look at PowerShell desired state first. So I'll start here. So this is probably about as basic a PowerShell desired state config file as you can get. It applies, it's a configuration called IIS install. It's applied to a node called localhost. And it's got a Windows feature, IIS. It's got to be present, so ensure equals present, and you can ensure equals not present, or whatever the opposite of that is. And the name of the feature, so it's the Windows feature name, is called web server. So basically, it's a feature. When I call it, I'll call the IIS configuration, and it will make sure that the web server component is installed for me as part of that. So so what we do first up, and this is a 200-level session, I'm sorry, but there, you know, they say if you're showing PowerShell, it should be a 300-level session, but I think you're all smart people, so 200-level should be fine. So what we do is first we've got to publish this this configuration up into Azure Storage, and there's a PowerShell commandlet that does that. It's this publish Azure VM DSC configuration, and it tells you what configuration. We're going to publish up this webconfiguration.ps1 file. And it's just going to publish it into a storage account. And so if I run that, it will or should publish up that configuration through to Azure Storage. And oh, it's done. So here's my Azure Storage account. I'm using this rather imaginatively named CloudBerry Explorer. There's my container, Windows PowerShell DSC. If I refresh that, we should now see. So it creates a zip file for us, uploads it, and stores it in Azure Storage. That file's sitting there ready for us to use. We're good to go. So all we have to do then is actually create an Azure VM. And using PowerShell, don't worry too much about the rest of the PowerShell. In fact, I'll show you this one because it's a bit clearer, or it's not. A bit clearer. This one, so all we do is say when we're creating the VM, set the configuration state. We're looking at that webconfiguration.ps1.zip file, and we want you to apply the configuration that's called IIS install. So that was the name of that configuration in that file, IIS install. So when we run this, it will go off and create me a VM in the West US region, and it will apply that configuration automatically. So in 5 minutes or so, we'll have a VM up and running with IIS installed, configured the way I want it. So, you know, and I did show you probably the most basic configuration you could ever want. You know, just install that feature. You can be really complicated about this. You could have your web content copying in as well. You could have all sorts of crazy things happening through this file. So, you know, you can do variables and all sorts of things. You know, if it's a particular role, do this type of thing. You know, you can be quite complicated with PowerShell desired state config. So it is just standard desired state config. Azure just knows how to interpret that and use the stuff stored in the environment. So that will take a few minutes to run. So I'm not going to wait for that. It's starting and it will continue on. So what I'll do is I'll move on to automation. And Azure Automation is down here. So Azure Automation, you can see it's in preview. So one scenario that people a lot of people use Azure for is dev test. So I want to run up my dev test environments in Azure because it's actually cheaper for me to do that, and it's easier for me to do it than having spare capacity or building a dev test farm on my on-premises environment and, you know, paying extra licenses and blah, blah, blah. But actually, my developers only usually work you know, maybe it's 8 till 6. Is it for me? turn off. you're embarrassing me. So my developers only work 8 till 6. I mean, no offence to you three developers over there, they probably don't, really. Maybe it's 10 till 4, but, you know, they only work from 8 till 6. You know, I've got VMs running up here in Azure that I'm paying by the minute for. So why don't I just turn those development VMs off overnight? If I forget, I get billed for them, right? So why don't I just turn them off automatically? So that's what one of the things you can do with Azure Automation. So we'll come in here. I've got two rather imaginative runbooks, start VMs and stop VMs. I'll have a look at this. this runbook is really, really simple. It does a bunch of stuff. Sorry, it's not hugely clear. It's a little bit gray, but it does a bunch of stuff. It takes two parameters in, a VM name and a cloud service name, and uses a couple of variables stored in the Azure automation configuration. But that very last line is the last bit, is the bit that does actually the hard work. Start Azure VM minus name, blah, blah, blah. So it starts a VM. Pretty straightforward, right? And so we can run that. Small VM 01, and there's the service name, and it's also the VM name. And if I go like that, it will eventually go off and it will start a job to do this. It takes a little while for you to actually see that reflected in the console. So I'll keep talking, and hopefully you'll kind of get the idea, and we'll have a look at small VM 01 in a second to make sure it started. So, but the other thing is, well, actually, yeah, I just did that manually. That's kind of okay, but I want to schedule this thing to run. So you can see I've got a schedule set up here, and click that way. Yes, you can see. You can see the next run is set for there. Next run is set for 8 a.m. So at 8 a.m. every morning, this thing runs, turns on my VMs, and away it goes. And it's up and running within seconds. And you can see it's run. It's been running. And you can see it's set up, down the bottom here. You can see it's set to run against small VM 01, which is the same one we're doing at the moment. And you know, same thing with my stop VMs. I've got schedule applied to that. And same thing at 8:20, it shuts those VMs off again. So I'm being billed for 20 minutes worth of usage. So you know, if you've got your dev VMs, you want to turn them off for between 5 and 8. You've just saved 2/3 of the cost of running those VMs automatically. So. And you can do all sorts of other things with this, but that's just one example of the sorts of things you could do with PowerShell, with the automation feature. With any luck, that's kind of triggered through to my VMs, and maybe it's even starting. It hasn't got there yet. It does take a few minutes to kind of figure itself out and go, I'm going to start. But eventually, that small VM will start and continue. And continue running. So that's the orchestration automation piece. And I'll just kick off a process to run create a VM in Southeast Asia for me as well. And so you can see, oh, look, there you go. Small VM 1 is just started now. So it took, 3 or 4 minutes? Felt like an eternity up here, but I'm just kidding. So it's starting, it's running, and automatically, I triggered it manually, but that's what happens. And so you can do that round across your fleet easy as. So that's automation. Right. Any questions?
How complex can you make those startup and shutdown scripts? For example, can you see if the VM has been idle 30 minutes and then shut down?
The question is, how complex can you make those things? You know, could you see if a machine's been idle for X number of time or whatever it happens to be? I don't think so. I don't know if you could pull out the metrics from Azure Diagnostics and use that. I'm not sure if that's exposed yet, but that's kind of, I guess that's the kind of thing you could look at doing. That's probably a bit trickier, but yeah. Yeah, but you can, it is PowerShell, so you're kind of limited by your imagination. And if you can get access to the data somehow, then potentially, yes. It's just a question of kind of making it happen, really.
Can you PS remote into the box itself?
Can you PS remote into the box by itself? I don't see any reason why not. One of the things you'd have to do is ensure that you trust the certificate that's set up on the box for management, and that Azure is able to, you're able to use the right certificate to authenticate. That's probably something you'd need to consider, but there's no reason at all why not. Does DSC not double up on group policy? Yes, to a certain extent. You could achieve. I think you could. There'd be an overlap. It'd be like one of those nice Venn diagrams. There'd be kind of an overlap in the middle, which would be. There are certain things you could achieve with group policy, but not with PowerShell DSC. There's certain things you can achieve with PowerShell DSC and not with group policy. And so it kind of depends on what your scenario is going to be. So yes and no. Like, you know, there is an overlap, but and it's kind of good as a validation as well of your group policy, because if DSC's got nothing to do because group policy has configured the machine the way you want it, it's a validation. And so you can, it will do nothing. If DSC sees the state has changed for any reason, it will force that state back. So it's kind of a cross-check if you thought of it that way. But I think it's aimed at doing more than what you can achieve with group policy. There'd be a certain subset of things you could do there. Does the DSC agent support configurations where it's split out into a hash table? That I don't know. It's a 200 level session. yeah, nice try. I honestly don't know the answer to that.
Is it possible to have more than one configuration applied to a single machine?
Is it possible to have more than one desired state configuration applied to a machine? Yeah, it is. Because you can have, you could just tell it to apply this configuration, then that configuration, as long as they don't conflict. but yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think I'll press on. Next thing, think multi-data center. So Azure's got all these data centers all around the world, Asia, US, Europe. Microsoft said last week that Australia's coming soon. Apparently it's in private preview, so pretty soon one on our kind of back doorstep. So think about multi-data center. And so what are some of the ways we can think about multiple data centers? There's a couple that have kind of come to light over the last 6-9 months. VNet to VNet routing and traffic manager. So what's VNet to VNet routing? Well, I've created a virtual network in West US, and I decide I want a new virtual network in Australia somewhere. What we used to have to do was connect those two. If I wanted to route between those two virtual networks, they're both isolated networks inside Azure. If I wanted to route between those two virtual networks, I'd have to connect them up to my on-premises network and route that way, which is a bit of a pain. And I might be building something with a business partner, and I don't want to have to route traffic between that business partner and my, their virtual network and my virtual network through my corporate network. So what VNet to VNet routing does is it allows us to create a VPN between those two virtual networks in different regions, or even, I guess, in the same region, as long as they're in different IP ranges or whatever. I can create a virtual network to virtual network connection, and it allows me to basically treat those two virtual networks as a routed network. So then I can run services that need to replicate data between, say, between Europe and US, or between Australia and Asia. So I can replicate traffic, replicate data across those links now, as though because they are a private virtual network for me. So that's what virtual VNet to VNet connectivity does. One of the scenarios that is enabled is that is cross-region SQL always on. So if I'm building a service that needs to be resilient across multiple regions, then I can build an always on cluster now that replicates across. So I can have that stuff in sync regardless of what region I'm in. So if I have, complete disaster in one of the US regions and the data center melts down completely, I can fail my service over to, be it another one in the US or Asia or wherever it happens to be replicating to. So you've got options around making your services highly available.
Stuart, does that 99.95%
SLA still apply when you start using VNet to VNet? Does the 99.95% SLA still apply when you're using VNet to VNet? No. Yes and no. If you're running two VMs in an availability set in a single geo, that's when your SLA applies. If you're running two VMs in different geos, then the SLA wouldn't apply, but it might not matter so much to you, because provided you can, provided the scenario is that if there is a maintenance event over on one data center, I can fail my service over to the other data center seamlessly. If you're running, say, active passive, that might not work. But it doesn't. You don't get a 99.95% availability as VNet to VNet. The other one is Traffic Manager, and it's really aimed at web traffic. So Traffic Manager is basically DNS with a policy engine. So what it allows me to do is set up my customer URL, myapp.com, and have Traffic Manager, and Traffic Manager manages that, and it gives me a bunch of load balance, different policies around where that traffic gets directed. So I can set up, a performance one, which is what's my closest data center? So it figures out based on the network latency between you and that data center, what's the closest one? Or I could just say, it's around Robin. You'll just go to one of these data centers in the list. Or I can say it's a failover. I've got a primary data center and a failover data center. So I can build an application that is spanned across multiple data centers, and I can have traffic delivered to that data center. And, conceivably, you could be doing that with SQL always on, replicating underneath, providing an in-sync backend across those data centers as well. So that's what Traffic Manager does. How it works is kind of you set up your standard, www.contoso.com. It's a CNAME, not an A record, so you just point your CNAME at a specific traffic manager URL, it might be contoso.trafficmanager.net, and then that takes care of making sure stuff goes where you want. So that can point at Azure Cloud Services, so VMs running in Azure. It can also point to Azure websites. So I'm not going to talk about Azure websites today, but if there's Azure websites, you can run it there, or even non-Azure endpoints now. So you can actually route to, say you had an on-premises thing that you wanted to route to as well, then that could be included in it. And the scenarios could be, I've got I'm running a bunch of web services on a bunch of VMs, and I'm doing a whole bunch of cool things. But if I want to do maintenance, maybe I redirect everything to just a maintenance page running in an Azure website. So it's running a free Azure website, but it just gives me a maintenance page. There's a bunch of different scenarios you can do here. So again, just give a quick look at Traffic Manager. So let's have a look, Traffic Manager. So down here I've got this Traffic Manager set up. I've called it Datacom Cloud. And if I look here at the dashboard, you can see it's got a name, that DNS name down there, datacomcloud.trafficmanager.net. So that's my Traffic Manager specific URL. I'd create my www record pointing at, or CNAME record pointing at that name. You can also see there that it's inactive because I haven't got any endpoints configured on it. So all I need to do is say, I need to add some endpoints and I want to add some cloud services. And so I created some VMs before, probably that one and that one I think I created. And if I go OK, so those are my two VMs that I just spun up using that PowerShell desired state configuration. So heaven help me, I've chosen the right ones. And so this thing now becomes active, and in theory, it should come active eventually. In theory, I should be able to hit that Traffic Manager URL. And there you go, there's a blank IIS Windows Server. So that's the Windows Server I spun up using desired state config and told it to install the web server component. So you can see it's installed the web server component for me. So the desired state config bit has worked. So another thank you to the demo gods. And the Traffic Manager has routed me to one of the two instances. I've got no idea which one. And I can come and see what the policy is around it. At the moment it's failover, which means it's set to one active, one active passive. So at the moment I will have gone to West US. If West US should fail, it'll just take me to Southeast Asia. But you can see there, I can just say, change it to performance, and and make that change, and it'll just start routing me based on whichever data center's closest to me. So it's kind of super easy, and it's easy to set up, and kind of just works and seamlessly. So it's a good way to think multi-data center.
Stu, on that performance one, can you select the metric that it's using? Overall performance of the connection?
Yes, so the question is, can you select the metric? And the answer is no, it's based on performance of you, basically between you and that and the Traffic Manager endpoint. It kind of figures it out using network latency. I think it's just ICMP or something.
So it's kind of a lightweight replacement for F5 GTM.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it's a lightweight replacement for GSLB type device. Yeah, absolutely. And part of the service inside Azure, you pay a certain amount per number of redirects that you've done. There's a kind of a free bit, so it depends on how busy your service is, how much you pay. Yeah, so the question is it smart enough to detect if your application's working? So what time does this thing finish? Anyone know? 10 past, go on, okay. I better go quickly. Good question. So is it smart enough to figure out if your application's down? Yeah, that's what this bit does. This monitoring thing does. So you can see there I've got two options. I can monitor if HTTP or HTTPS. I can tell it which port's running on. So if I'm running on a non-standard port for some reason, I can tell it to do that. And I can, if I need to use a custom monitoring page or whatever to check status, I can do that. Basically, if it gets a 200 back out of your web server, it'll say, yep, fine. If it gets anything else, it'll take it out of load balancing pool. So it does detect state. Right, better get cracking. I've only got 20 minutes. Leverage Azure Storage. So Azure Storage is a great feature. It's cool. I don't know if you went to Jaron's session this morning, he would have talked about Azure Storage, the way it stores three copies of your data in the data center. If one of those disks dies, Azure just takes care of that, writes another copy somewhere, and then you can enable geo-redundant storage, and you can have six copies of your data in two different data centers. So it's actually a really, really cool feature, but the kind of bummer about it is that, hey, we're infrastructure guys and gals, and we're used to protocols like iSCSI and SMB and Fibre Channel and those kinds of things. And Azure Cloud Storage is accessed via something called REST. And, I'm an infrastructure guy. The only thing I know about resting is when I have a lie on the couch on a Saturday. It's kind of foreign to me. So I can't necessarily use this stuff without having to know, about programming and JSONs and, I don't know, whatever developers talk about, So how do I as an infrastructure person use this stuff? The other thing is actually we're also used to, infrastructure guys, we're talking, was it 8 gig fiber these days? I don't know. So we're talking massively fast connections to fiber. And so now you want me to stick data on something that I have to, upload over a wet noodle across to some remote data center somewhere. How's that going to work in terms of performance and latency and bandwidth? What bandwidth am I going to consume to do this stuff? The other thing is the NSA are going to sniff all my data when it's up there in the data center because that's what Snowden says they do. So I can't be sure that this isn't going to happen. So how do I worry? I'm worried about security. What's going to happen? As if they're interested in my data. What are we going to do about security? And so this is where hybrid cloud storage comes in. And so what Microsoft did is they acquired a company called StorSimple. And you might have heard about this before. There's a session on later on in the week about StorSimple as well. So what StorSimple does is it gives you an appliance that runs on your premises, provides you an iSCSI target for storage. So it's a protocol where we're infrastructure people, understand iSCSI, that makes sense. You hook your devices up to this thing with the iSCSI, and then it takes care of translating the data you're writing to the appliance. It then translates that and writes it up to the Azure storage system using the HTTP REST API. So, and what that does is because it's a device that sits on premises, it's actually got a bunch of local cache in it. So that local cache, and it's a lot of local cache, and the data that goes onto the device is deduped and compressed as it hits the device. And so there's a bunch of storage you get on premises. So anything that's kind of hot or warm, any data that's currently in use or has been used reasonably recently will sit on the device. And when you access it, it'll be nice and fast and exactly as expected. But then if you're like most organizations, and I think the organization I work for is no different, you've got these giant file servers which have been there since maybe 1940, and they've got terabytes and terabytes of data. Everyone's too scared to delete anything because hey, we might get sued, or we might need that for another project, or we might need to pick up what we did for that customer, or you know, it might be something really important. And so people go, well, there's all this data, I've got no idea what to do with it, but I know that I have to keep it. And not only that, I have to back the damn stuff up as well. So what Store Simple does is it says, well, if that data's cold and you haven't touched it for a while and I'm running out of space, I'm just going to fire that up to the cloud and store it on the cloud. And I'm going to take advantage of the economics of the fact that I can buy storage in Azure for 5 cents a gig and I can geo-replicate it. And so now I've got two copies. And the cool thing is I'm also going to encrypt it on the way up, and I'm going to encrypt it with the license key that you hold. So in the end, we end up with a big blob of data sitting in Azure that is encrypted, but I'm paying for what I use, so that scenario, then I've offloaded a whole bunch of data that I don't need to store on premises. All I've got is the data that I'm actually using. And the cool thing is, from there, I can then take snapshots on the device. So I can take a snapshot every hour if I want to, and that's my daily or hourly backups, right? So now I need to recover, I can just present that snapshot back to my device as another volume, and recover data off it. And I can also take what are called cloud snapshots. And guess what? A cloud snapshot's just a snapshot stored in the cloud. It's a pretty imaginative name, really. But what that lets you do is that's your offsite backup handled right there. It's your long-term backup, so that's your weeklies, your monthlies, your yearlies. I can store that stuff all in Azure. That stuff's all offloaded. It's deduped. It's compressed. It's not transferring up any data that's already there, so I'm managing the bandwidth well. The Store Simple device actually covers up the whole scenario. So I've got storage on premises, I've got archive stuff, I've backed it up. It's replicated in Azure, so I've got DR for it. And with the new 8000 series of Store Simple devices, you can actually, if your Store Simple on premises dies or your whole data center dies, whatever, you can actually recover using a virtual appliance running in Azure. You can mount the storage in Azure using a virtual Store Simple appliance. Store Simple was a great way for infrastructure people to be able to leverage the economics of Azure storage. So I'll skip that slide because time. The other bit of Azure, the other way we can see Azure storage is this feature called Azure Files. And what Azure Files does is exposes Azure storage as an SMB share. And hey, infrastructure people understand SMB shares. Net use, server name, share name. Hey, done. The cool thing about Azure Files is, you know, it leverages the Azure storage system. We've got three copies in the back end there. But it lets us treat that as a standard old Windows file share. What it's aimed at, though, it's not aimed at running stuff outside Azure. So it is aimed, you know, only Azure VMs can access that storage file share. You can't access it, say, from your on-premises environment. But what it's great for is, hey, I'm running out VMs with shared config. So I've got IIS VMs that have got IIS shared config pointed at Azure File Share rather than running up a file server and having to worry about that being highly available. Azure Storage, it's highly available anyway, and away I go. I might want to log diagnostic stuff somewhere, you know, those kinds of things. There's scenarios like that. I might have apps that I need to pick up and lift that rely on a file share. Rather than running highly available file share, just use Azure Files. So great, another way that we can leverage the coolness of Azure storage, but as you know, using it as IT professionals, using a protocol that we understand rather than HTTP REST or whatever it happens to be. Use the VM Depot. So I don't know how many of you know about the VM Depot in Azure. So Azure provides a bunch of images for VMs, Windows, funnily enough, lots of Windows, SQL, SharePoint, some Linuxes, Microsoft provide a bunch of Linux images for Ubuntu, SUSE, CentOS, those kinds of things. But there's also this thing called the VM Depot. And the VM Depot is basically, it's a catalog of VMs that others have uploaded that are available for running on Azure. And so they could be, you see a lot of Linuxes in the VM Depot, a lot of Linuxes, a lot of pre-configured stacks. So, hey, I want a LAMP development stack, bang, there's one here, just spin it out from the VM Depot and away you go. But there's also a couple of other bits and pieces, so some quite useful stuff, like there's a Kemp load balancer in there, I think there's a Riverbed load balancer in there as well. So you can actually deploy the appliances that some of these vendors have pushed up in there as well. So it's not just Linux, it's other stuff as well. You can access it directly on that URL, VM Depot. or the images tab in the portal, or the new portal actually has the whole VM Depot fully integrated, so it's actually just a part of the environment. I will just quickly show you, but it takes 30 seconds. Probably take long, yeah, longer to cross the monitor over. If I go new, I'll go up to virtual machines up here. If I go to images, you'll see down the bottom here, I've got Browse VM Depot. If I click that, I can get a look at the gazillions and gazillions of things that are available in the VM Depot eventually. Yeah, so there you go. So there are a lot of bits and pieces, CentOS, Discourse, whatever that happens to be. If I wanted that Kemp load balancer there, I can spin that stuff up. If I want the Riverbed one, it's down here somewhere. So there are a bunch of things that you can do here. Like you can see there's gazillions of them. You just got to be really accurate with your scrolling. That's all I really wanted to show you on that. It is, like I say, it's fully integrated in the new portal. Okay. Next one, think outside the box. So Azure puts some constraints on what you can do. And I guess when you're thinking about those constraints, you don't necessarily have to work inside those constraints. You can work around the constraints. So one example I've got here is, hey, the load balancer behaves in a certain way. If you're sitting behind the Azure load balancer, it's an active load balancer, round robin style traffic delivery. It doesn't do kind of active passive. So if you wanted to deliver a service, if you wanted to pick up a service that you've currently got running on premises and run it in Azure, but it only supports active passive, this is a real scenario, then you can't put it behind the load balancer because the load balancer just start go one. That one goes to the active, that one goes to the passive, that one goes active, that one's passive, and so you can't really do that. So, hey, think about doing something different. Use an alternative solution. Use the Kemp, use the Riverbed, use the Barracuda appliance. Build your own based on some open source thing, HA proxy, whatever it happens to be. Leverage the VM Depot where you can to kind of provide pre-provision stuff, but don't be constrained by what you think Azure can do. If you think outside the box, it might be, this one might be application request routing, but there are constraints, understand them, but also understand that you can do things without worrying about those constraints if you use your brains and the features built into other operating systems or whatever it happens to be. Just, I guess don't be constrained by the basics. The last thing, I'm doing great for time. Is the migration accelerator, and don't ask me any questions on this because I'll just say I don't know. And the reason I put it in here is because it came out over the weekend, and so I just kind of wanted to make you guys aware of it because it's actually really cool. Microsoft acquired this company I think back in July called InMarge, and they do a bunch of migration and migration kind of work. And so what the migration accelerator does is it allows you to move a physical VM or an AWS VM or a VMware or a Hyper-V VM up to Azure. And so what it does is it provides kind of an agent-based technology which synchronizes the VM up to an Azure virtual machine. So it'll take care of kind of any format conversions because it's running inside the guest. It will take care of those format conversion style things, replicate that up to Azure. And what it lets you do is keep a VM in sync between your on-premises and the Azure instance. It allows you then, I want to test that VM and make sure it actually works in Azure, so I can do a non-destructive test, spin it up in Azure, see what happens, see what breaks, see what needs to be fixed. And then if I'm ready, I can actually just say, hey, cut this over, and so it'll turn off that one, start the new one running in Azure, and do the cutover for you. Also, it'll do, if you've got multi-tier apps, you can say, this needs to go over and it needs to be consistent at this point in time. So my SQL database and my web front end need to be consistent. Bang, away it goes. It'll do that stuff for you. It supports 2008 R2, SP1 and above. And so it's Windows only at the moment. I don't know if there's any plans for Linux. But it's a cool bit of functionality. Like I say, don't ask me any more questions because I've read the blog post. And that's what I've done. So if you want to see the blog post, azure.microsoft.com/blog. It's one of the more recent ones. Like I say, it just got announced over the weekend. I'm going, oh yeah, what does this thing actually mean? It's actually really, really cool technology. So something to kind of keep in mind if you're looking at doing some migration work or whatever it happens to be. There. So I guess in summary, Azure's a big platform. It does a lot of things, and it does more things every week, it seems. So if you think beyond the computer network stack and the other things you can do, you can actually make it do some really, really cool things. And the other thing is learn PowerShell. You won't regret learning PowerShell when it comes to Azure or Windows or anything else. And that is what the Fox says about Azure. And look, there are some really, really cool sessions coming up later on. Nick from Provoke's got a great session on automating Azure. Jaron and Ben are talking about Store Simple VNX, so the 8000 series. Alessandro is talking about enterprise scale DR, so using Azure DR and Hyper-V, Azure Site Recovery Manager and those kinds of things. There is a service management automation session later on. And there is also an Azure Active Directory, which we didn't talk about today, but there is an Azure Active Directory session coming up later as well. So there are a bunch of really, really cool sessions coming up. So make sure you go and see them. And that's kind of about all we've got time for. So thank you very much. Fill in your evals and do all that stuff. You all got given a screwdriver on the way in? Well, not all of you. Well, most of you did, or some of you did anyway. Those of you with screwdrivers, there is a ticket inside some of those screwdrivers. And you get a Porsche. So if you've got a screwdriver, open it up. If there's a ticket inside it, that gentleman over there is Dirk. If you go and see Dirk, if you've got a golden ticket, you get a trip to Willy Wonka's factory and one of these Lumia 520 phones as well. So hopefully, you didn't get one?
No.
Fair enough.